Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Morality of Everyday Things. This is part two of the question, are luxury goods immoral?
Yes, a quick intro. Like Jake said, this is part two, so really recommend listening to part one. It probably won't make much sense without it. Morality of Everyday Things is a podcast about everyday philosophy. Won't do the same intro because you must listen to part one. Thank you to those who leave reviews. We had a recent one that was very funny that actually considered our point balanced despite being carnist. This was on the Me Eating episode. Actually, that's honestly what I strive for. If someone who fundamentally disagrees with us can listen and still hear value in the discussion, that to me is everything.
Then we're winning. We're achieving what we set out to do.
And also thank you to those who contribute on our Patreon. You can do it for as little as $1 a month, and it really does help cover our production costs and also keep the podcast going and improve them over time.
Wonderful. All right. So,
Shout out to George Kerr. Same one again. Recording the same day, so you get them both.
You get a double up. So in part one, a quick recap. We basically spent the whole episode discussing what is a luxury good.
Yeah. What's necessity? Where does the line draw?
Exactly. And often with philosophy, it's really important to be very clear on your definitions, which is why we gave it quite so much time.
And your implied definitions, because a necessary part, ironic use of the word necessary, ironic part of defining the word luxury is to define the counterpoint, what's needed.
Yeah, what is a necessity?
A large part of describing something as luxury is describing that which is not needed.
Exactly. So we looked at, for example, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the pyramid, where in that pyramid something sort of tips from being necessary into luxury. You could argue the fact that they're all needs. At no point does something become a luxury necessarily. God, it's confusing using the word necessary and necessarily and necessity and all these things. But we looked at the example of cars. At what point a car tips from being a sort of necessity into a luxury like a Ferrari? Yeah, the fact that it's not clear is obviously what makes it a really interesting question. We gave some basic definitions, and one of the ones we'll definitely come back to is Ant looked at two classes of luxury good.
Yes, that's not a formal one. That's one that we kind of intuitively wanted to describe two sets of them, and they seem to be morally distinct. Mm-hmm. One is things that are expensive and clearly not necessary, but are arguably good value. So that would be, for example, let's take that car analogy that we're talking about, right? You know, maybe getting the car that, you know, strictly it's more than you quote unquote need, but has a good AC system, has a nice sound system.
Is electric, right? For example.
Is electric maybe starts to veer into
You bring in the whole climate change thing.
Yeah. You bring in the whole, like, more, a whole other moral imperative. But, you know, has these kind of extras that, like, you could actually kind of argue are kind of functional and, like, maybe meet levels of need. They're a little higher, like, self-esteem, etc. Not just the sort that, like, you could argue, like, well, yeah, but, like, you might derive value in that. But, like, should you derive value in that?
That's,
like,
why I think electric is interesting, though. Apart from the climate change argument, it does drive at that point of, like, one. Well, it is for that point, right? It's the sort of self-expression of, I'm the kind of person who cares about this.
Got you.
And they are necessarily more expensive right now.
Yeah. But it does also happen to coincide with actually doing good.
Let's,
you know, on the one hand, we have those sorts of luxuries, right? Mm-hmm. If you draw scale, they seem to be like halfway along, right? And they're in more of the gray area. Granted, I said AC and sound system. I mean, you know, those sound pretty ridiculous, but you know what I mean? Like, hey, what about an automatic car rather than a manual car, right? Like, it's just less effort to drive. It's easier, but they're significantly more expensive. Maybe that's an example of it. And then you get to the other point where it's you're starting to veer into what we would call conspicuous consumption. That's having a sports car. There is no functional need to have this thing. And maybe it's fulfilling some sort of, you know, it's providing value to you.
It's fun to drive.
It's fun to drive, and it's a status symbol. But it starts to veer into the realm of status symbol where, you know, maybe a more considered person might start to think, like, okay, well, but, like, maybe the things that this communicates about you aren't so good.
And I think the fact, something we kept coming back to was, you know, humans exist in a social context. Obviously, consumption exists in a social context. I think what certainly the issue we were kind of driving at there is if you're purchasing these kind of goods, and you're there to communicate your wealth in a world of, like, immense inequality, in a world of poverty.
This is where we're going to come to it.
Yeah.
Right? It almost becomes distasteful. So when we approach this problem and we think about these unnecessary but sometimes nice goods that are meeting needs or not, that are higher up that kind of chain of needs, Maslow's hierarchy that we mentioned last time, there's two key arguments that we could start to kind of consider here, right? And you kind of touched on one of them, opportunity cost. We'll come back to that.
There's a big one.
There's a smaller one let's touch on really quickly. Immorality in production.
Yeah, we'll give this one relatively short shrift because it doesn't uniquely apply to luxuries. It can just as easily apply to necessities. Mm-hmm. What we're saying here is if there are moral issues in the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you mentioned earlier, like, I actually don't know if Gucci are guilty of this, but, like, let's say luxury fashion goods that are produced in sweatshops. Yeah. Gucci very might well be. I don't know. I'm not making allegations.
No idea. I don't want to make allegations.
Yeah. But let's say you've produced a luxury handbag and you've produced it in a sweatshop, and that comes along with all the sort of moral baggage of like treatment of workers, etc. Yes.
And then suddenly when it's not a necessity,
yeah,
it really changes the moral cost there in a kind of exponential way.
Right? It does, because you could make the very same argument against what I remember Primark did have a case years ago where they were saying, okay, a lot of their goods, a lot of their clothing is produced in sweatshops, but Primark produces really cheap clothes that are affordable and people need clothes to wear. To be fair, it's an interesting thing. If you want to be consequentialist about it, the scale is interesting because obviously very few people consume really high-end luxury fashion, tons of people are buying fast fashion.
Yeah.
And
well, I think that's an interesting point, and there's different moral costs there. Both externalities, I guess the thing that's so painful about the luxury good one is like, one, the entire process doesn't need to exist because it's not a necessary good. Mm-hmm. But then two, even more poignantly, and this kind of comes to what we were saying about high margin earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're selling something that is that expensive with that high a margin, there's no need
for the problems.
Yeah. As in, well, it depends on the product. We'll come back to, for example, blood diamonds.
Yep.
But, you know, there's no need to use a sweatshop when the good is that expensive. Again, this comes to that difficult argument we discussed in part two where it's like, well, you know, just because something's making a high margin doesn't mean it's not necessary for that business.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe their business model only makes sense in that context, etc. But generally, you know, when something sells for hundreds of thousands and only costs tens to make, you could see an argument that like, okay, throw in an extra 10 or 20 and you could actually pay people fairly to do it. And then also when it comes to outsourcing, there's this whole wider issue of like, okay, on the one hand, maybe it's like, it sounds ridiculous on an international scale. Maybe those aren't crazy hours locally.
Mm-hmm.
I think really though, when someone uses a sweatshop, it is the kind of like, you know, you're getting children to work excessive hours sort of a vibe rather than fair local labor.
Yeah, yeah. It's a pejorative term. Another couple of examples, just to really hammer home the point. So on the necessity point, you've got battery farm chickens or battery farmed animals in general. And this is something we talked about, particularly in our episode on vegetarianism and veganism.
Yeah. Go back to that one. If you come back to that again, like meat is one of those gray area ones where like maybe it is a luxury good. Like it's expensive. You know, it's not necessary. You can survive without it. But it's a gray area because like I think there's a decent amount of people who any reasonable salary earning outside of like literal poverty, if you're not conscientiously a vegetarian or vegan, you will probably consume some meat. Right. But yes, like the point is, it's not a necessary thing to consume and it has a harmful supply chain, particularly when you want to produce it either cheaply or sometimes very expensively, it depends.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of problems in the supply chain beyond the sort of suffering of animals, which is the most obvious one to draw.
Fur, another one, same problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, again, this
and then fur's the sort of flip side. Fur's the luxury example of that, right?
Yeah. Fur is the one that's actually even more poignant than meat in general, which is why more and more people ban fur before we're talking about banning meat. It's just so unnecessary for animals to suffer for us to wear expensive coats.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Whereas people, the argument that like, oh, you know, someone needs to eat meat, that's that gray area.
Yeah, people have identified that. And battery chickens or battery farming in general has other problems such as like, you know, the viruses slipping out of the industrial meat complex.
Yep. And antibiotics, all that.
Antibiotics, exactly. Mainly it's about the suffering of animals. And we've already, the fur is actually a perfect sort of contrast to that because people have said, you know, we don't need it. It's not necessary.
When we're talking about those two luxury items, like...
They contrast perfectly.
Yeah, that's it actually. Like meat is a good example of like, it's not strictly necessary, but there's kind of like a gray area argument. And so like some of it, for example, I could see an argument that like beef is like tipping into the unnecessary immoral considering the
impact on climate
versus, for example, chicken. Whereas fur, like, you know, then we're veering to the conspicuous consumption. Like you are making animals suffer just for the point of conveying status, which we would agree is like a lesser need than consumption of meat.
It's worth clarifying here. We're not apologizing for battery production. Like, I think both of us completely agree and have said in other episodes that's something in an ideal world that you'd absolutely crack down on and you'd have systems for producing meat that are fairer to the animals involved and a less risk to sort of human society, etc. But we use that.
It's a clear distinction.
It's a clear distinction.
Yep. And then the other one is blood diamonds. So diamonds that kind of find their way into the market outside of regulated or official ways and the kind of conflict and warfare that kind
if you've
of
seen
causes.
The movie, you'll know. But yeah, for sure. And blood diamonds are interesting because we've now hit a point where lab-grown diamonds can, to all appearances, look exactly as good as the real thing.
Yep, and are much cheaper.
Cheaper to produce and at no risk of the sort of conflicts involved.
Yep. But overall, I mean, Jake, when you consider all these things, how much of that burden do we put on consumers?
That's the challenge with all these things. And we've talked about this in previous episodes before. In an ideal world, the way a healthy market, we believe, should function is that practices like this would be regulated out of existence at the production level, such that consumers aren't having to make a sort of choice of like, do you know what? I'm going to opt for the much more expensive meat because the cheap meat is clearly violating moral sort of things that I believe in.
I guess the alternative, but it effectively means the same thing, is that like you just would internalize externalities, right? Mm. So for example, if beef is causing lots of CO2 emissions,
we should tax it more.
We should tax it more and use the taxes to address those CO2 emissions.
Yeah, yeah. And you could tax the sort of, it would completely undermine the model, but if you could tax battery farmed meat effectively.
I mean, the problem is, how do you price that? Yeah. It's even harder than pricing carbon. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how do you alleviate it? Mm. But yeah, I mean, in effect, you could basically price it to the extent where like it becomes either impractical or diminishes the use and et cetera. But yeah.
The risk on the diamond side is if you tax it, it just drives the price up.
It's an even greater luxury now.
Exactly.
But yeah, sorry. So that's briefly immorality in production. But as we said, necessary goods have this too. It's just the fact that they're necessary helps to counterbalance. I mean, like classic moral argument, a utilitarian one for sure. Necessity is a superseding argument versus the cost of producing something.
Absolutely.
It's in the term necessary. Now, here's the big one for today. Yeah.
So that was argument one. Now we need to look at argument two,
which is really the meat.
Yeah. This is where we wanted to go with this episode. And this is looking at the opportunity cost of consumption.
Yeah. So we touched on this briefly at the end of last episode. And we gave that example of if you're buying a £10,000 purse, you know, is there not an argument that you could buy a £1,000 purse that functionally does everything you need, including looking good, right? Like, I'm not even saying it has to be a minimalist piece of junk or not be attractive. But if you have that $10,000 item and you can get something very similar for $1,000 and then you opt to donate, not even necessarily all of it, say you donate $8,000, right? You've saved $1,000, you've practically got everything except the brand, and the world is a better place. Or flip it around. What if, and increasingly this is the case, what if there are brands who are like, hey, look, we'll produce these luxury goods so it still meets the necessity of communicating status. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows that you bought something expensive, but we'll donate a crazy amount of our profits just to, you know, to supporting whatever causes. So it's ticking all the boxes. Like, you're communicating wealth whilst it's doing good. Like, why would you not choose that product over the purely expensive one?
Exactly. And I think in the definitions episode in part one, this was kind of the point that we were driving at when we were talking about conspicuous consumption being distasteful. It's because of this quote-unquote opportunity cost, i.e. what else you could have done with the money. Now, this argument was put forward very famously by utilitarian philosopher Peter Singer. I don't know if I've got the exact example, but I'll go with an example that makes the point. And I think he said something along these lines. Imagine you're walking along and you see a child drowning in a pond, but you're wearing expensive shoes. Mm. In the time it'll take you to take off your shoes to go in, the child will probably die. Mm. So you have a choice now between dive in, save the shoes at the...
dive
in to save the child at the risk to damaging your expensive shoes, or...
They're really nice suede.
Really nice. Or just walk on and, you know, the child dies, but hey, your shoes are still intact.
You have to do that thing in cartoons where like you have your hand behind your back and you go... like his eyes kind of looking around, like, act like you saw nothing.
Exactly. The reason the sort experiment is the reason it's effective is because the answer seems obvious to basically anyone. Mm. You know, obviously, £200 shoes, however expensive they are, you dive in and save the child. The child's life is obviously worth way more. And Singer then takes this argument, extends it, and says, you know, if you're willing to do away with your expensive shoes to save the child, shouldn't you ought to be willing to give to charity in the same way?
Or, I mean, well, that's the outcome, but like the explicit step is, if the shoes are 200, you're willing to give up 200 to save a life. So if there's a charity who can save a life in another far off place in the world for 200, you should give to that charity by the exact same logic, right?
Yeah. And now, this argument snowballs, right? Because doesn't he effectively say, actually, once you've met your basic needs and nuanced definition around where you draw that line, but you should be willing to give away anything surplus to effective charities who can do good in the world and to help other people meet their basic needs.
Basically, the world is full of suffering. As long as your life is okay, you should be willing to give up until the point that your life is starting to look kind of crap too. Mm-hmm. Because there are people who are suffering that immensely, and just access to some cash would change their life so much. Now, I think there's some like criticisms you can put on this that I think are perhaps unrealistic. So one embedded assumption from what we said there, which doesn't necessarily change the overall point, but a kind of assumption is that you're valuing everyone's utility the same, which I think practically is not true.
I think your own utility is more valuable to you than other people's.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Whether that should morally be the case, that's up for discussion. But I think practically, like, it's just not a fair description of humans. And then the other thing is also proximity. Proximity matters, right? So
the utility of people closer to you clearly matters more than people that you've never met far away on the other side of the planet.
Yeah. So, I mean, these are arguments you can make. But I think
you should, yeah.
But I think that, and I kind of get them. It's why I don't, like, literally just follow what Peter Singer says and clearly don't value literally anyone on the planet's utility the same. Mm-hmm. Another thing is family, friends, things like that, right? You clearly value those differently. It's not just proximity as in, like, are they literally close to me? The point there is simply that, like, you know, there are perhaps some holes you can make in the argument, but I think most reasonable people can kind of hear this argument and, you know, maybe you might be like, hey, I shouldn't give to the point of having nothing. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of hard to not hear that and be like, I probably should give more. Or the next time that you're making a luxury purchase, to at least not think like, do I really need this thing? Could I just give this money to, you know, mosquito nets or vaccinations or deworming pills or something that will probably help a lot of people?
Yeah, which is a good time to shout out Effective Altruism, because that's a I don't know what you describe it as, an organization, I guess, a campaign, a movement,
kind of. Yeah, I mean, a movement. It's Will McCaskill's, is he an Oxford professor? I don't know.
He is, yeah.
But it was kind of their initial thing where they're like, oh, like, it links to Peter Singer, because it's kind of the follow-on is that, like, if you have this vehicle of giving money to save lives, actually, the most moral thing you can do is, rather than working in an NGO, make as much money as possible to then give to these things. And as long as you're not detracting tons of value from the world in the process of making that money.
Do you know which ones are the most effective to give to? So they have a process of ranking charities and measuring their impact in different ways, so that you know that you're not giving money away wastefully. You're giving, because that would also undermine the point, right?
Yep. And also another one I really like. GiveWell, one of the most effective charities in the world. They just give money to people in need. Lots of evidence that it's the most effective way to help them whilst also respecting their autonomy, etc. Anyway, coming back to this point about Peter Singer,
there's a nice quote from him which says, I make a simple argument that challenges people to justify spending money on luxuries when that money could be used to save lives. And that links really nicely to the question, and it emphasizes the point really
well. It emphasizes the point. When you're buying luxury goods, there's an opportunity cost. You have avenues to give to save lives. He doesn't exclusively apply this to luxuries either, but it's especially relevant in the same way that we were talking about the immorality of production of things. It's especially relevant when, you know, your expenses are high, so, such that you're buying luxuries and the thing that you're buying is not necessary.
Yeah.
Right. Like, the extremist neophyte of utilitarianism might argue something to the extent of, like, listen, there are people who, you know, can't drink water. So, you know, that I am eating anything other than beans, bread, and, you know, whatever is, like, the bare minimum to survive is unfair. If you were truly, to the most extreme extent, adhering to this kind of, you know, all human utility is equal thing. But most people don't apply it to that extent, right? Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, however you see it, however you want to chop that, you know, the proximity arguments we made, etc. There's a fundamental thing when you get to the luxuries. It's like, I don't need this and I could save people's lives.
So that's Peter Singer, quite concisely explained. This is really the sort of philosophical idea underpinning the purpose of the question. Let's look at some rebuttals.
Okay, and this is really where we come back to that conception of necessity, what it is to be human, etc. First of all, the most obvious pairing against that a lot of people use in particular is this argument, or it stems from an essay by
Susan Wolf
on moral saints. And it basically talks about, what would it actually be like to be a moral saint? What might it take away from the human experience, right? And to kind of capture her point in a nutshell, she basically says, when you think about moral saints, you actually don't think about particularly happy people, happy lives. Mm. And you also might actually even say that, like, if you're taking a kind of ancient Greek perspective and you're talking about the quote-unquote good life, you may not describe what they're living as the good life, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you think about the context of moral saints, you know, moral saints would be people who are constantly making every decision in the context of, like, what is the moral thing to do, mm-hmm. would constantly be making sacrifices to that effect. And ultimately, some of the conclusions she comes to is that these people would be humorless because, first of all,
quite a funny example. Yeah,
humor and entertainment is frivolous. And also a lot of humor is at someone's expense.
Exactly.
Right? So it's, you know, morally better to just be, like, kind of ambivalent and bland. Lots of pursuits that we, you know, inherently, deeply might feel are, like, important to the human experience are morally arbitrary, right? Mm,
so, like, pursuing skills.
Yeah. So I mean, you might say, for example, there is some argument around, like, the aesthetic quality or like what the impact you're having on other people. It's funny how when you look at masterpieces, you can say that. But in individual cases, it's very hard to ever justify pursuing art, for example. You know, I said entertainment, art's another example, literature, drawing, in some context where that would win out over a moral thing.
Yeah, right. And like, should you can ever apply that to Peter Singer, right?
They're exactly. Saying,
like, why would you put any time or money into producing art when you could be saving lives?
When you could be volunteering or saving lives, exactly. And then it's some, you know, it's funny because, like, on the case by case, that seems, like, fair morally. It's hard to, but then when you imagine that world where art effectively doesn't exist, entertainment mm-hmm. effectively doesn't exist, it's one of those things where if you universalize it, you know, hey, it's great that Mother Teresa and Gandhi did exist, but should everyone be like them? Not just is there space, but does the world actually need the people who give you more to live than simply making sure everyone has that bottom base of Maslow's hierarchy? Maybe there's more to the human experience than that.
Maybe it's important to go higher up the pyramid, exactly. And there's something weirdly refreshing about reading Wolf, because I think the point she makes at the beginning is, while you start thinking about like what it is to be good, you can very easily put pressure on yourself to be, at some level, it's like, okay, I'm not a bad person. I don't go around killing people, you know, I don't steal. But when you think about what it is to be good, and you sort of put that pressure on yourself of like, you know, how do I make every action as good as possible? She kind of comes at it and says, you know what, if you actually make the argument, if you extend it to its logical extreme, life becomes really boring. Not necessarily every action is a moral action. To some extent, there's just more to
actually,
life than this.
She goes beyond that, I would say. And she kind of makes the argument in the essay. Sorry, I don't have the exact quote that says this, but she kind of makes the argument of, you might have heard people say like, don't turn your hobbies into your job or something like that. And she kind of makes the point where like, okay, maybe there's some conception of morality that can encompass this human need for these generally amoral activities that, you know, contribute a lot to the human experience, like literature, art, etc., right? But then anytime you try to do that, at some level, you turn these things into imperatives. And it's kind of the moral equivalent of this kind of neoliberal capitalist perspective that we should always be productive. And even the rest should only be, you know, in the service of being productive later, right? There's an extent to which that's a helpful way of seeing the world. And there's another extent to which it totally degrades the quality of the thing that you're trying to do, right? You know what? Sometimes I just want to enjoy myself. Sometimes I just want to enjoy a book. I don't need to every single book be kind of having that meta level of thought, like, is this
good for me?
Yeah, is this good for me? Is this morally enriching? And she kind of makes that argument too. I'm torn on this, right? Because on the one hand, Singer's argument is super appealing. On the other, you kind of read hers and it almost comes across as immaturely permission to disagree with Singer.
Yeah, right. That's exactly how it reads. I agree.
I don't necessarily mean that to say that she's right, but my deep sense is that there's something there. Both of them, maybe, like we're saying, there's attacks on Singers, there's attacks that you can make on this, but both of them have a nugget of truth, right?
I think so.
The life that you live should not be viewed purely through a moral lens, right? And similarly, you know, you shouldn't walk around completely uncognizant of the ability that you have to benefit other people. And the reason that this all comes back to luxury goods is because I actually feel like luxury goods, the conspicuous spending luxury goods, are a really convenient category to be like, you know what? I think this satisfies both. Like, I am not saying that I can't live a life that is enjoying something beyond the moral and moral weighing up of every bloody thing I do, right? I'm not saying that suddenly a really nice analogy from Cliff Mark, he actually has a good episode on this, Good In Theory podcast. We did a crossover with him, cool guy.
We did, episode 24, check it out.
You know, when I'm watching a movie, do I need to be thinking like, is this movie representative enough? Is it approaching moral points worth approaching? Like at some point, sometimes I just want to watch a movie. Sometimes I want to watch an Adam Sandler movie and just relax and enjoy it, right? I love that an Adam Sandler movie is like the staple of a bad movie. But it's completely devoid of moral value.
It comes from the Netflix example where they, sorry, this is the tangent, but it's funny. Netflix were trying to figure out how to do their ratings algorithm. And they were like, we have an interesting problem here because Schindler's List is consistently the highest rated movie on the platform. It's like 5-star. No one gives it less than 5-star, or very rarely do. But
fear that anyone finds out.
Yeah, but not very many people watch Schindler's List. And you compare that to Adam Sandler, which
you watch it in a different way.
Which gets like Adam Sandler movies were averaging like 3-star or less, but people just kept coming back to watch them again and again. And they're like, something is missing here because the review system doesn't capture the fact that Schindler's List is an aspirational movie and people rate it highly, but you don't enjoy it in the same way as the Adam Sandler movies that you give an example of, where actually you kind of want trash TV sometimes. You kind of want something that's just easy watching, and then eventually they weighted the algorithm accordingly to be like to capture both effects. Sorry, tangent there.
No.
But totally your point.
That is exactly it. Sometimes part of being human is just wanting to enjoy like some simple pleasure.
So if I were to kind of synthesize the two, I think you could treat this question a little bit as like, where do you draw the line in terms of what proportion of your actions should you make moral? And Singer sets like, he gives one example.
Sets a very high bar.
The bar is very high. It's basically like,
anytime you spend anything you don't need to spend.
Exactly.
Right.
And then Wolf kind of flips it and says, do you know what? If you did that, life would be really, really boring. And it almost feels like she gives you permission to go the other way and say, you know, actually, There's no point trying to make everything moral at all.
Yep.
And it feels like, I think the fact that you said there's nuggets of truth in both speaks to me to the fact that the line is somewhere in between.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's the reason I find luxury goods so interesting is it's because, as with many line drawing arguments, can I say exactly where to draw the line? It's hard. It depends. It context, etc.
But you can't tell where it's like definitely wrong.
Yeah. And one of those points is luxury goods where the sole purpose is status, conspicuous spending, etc. Coming back to it, you know, when we're talking about cars, I'm not talking about the car that has AC and radio and, you know, maybe some features like self-parking or it's automatic, right? Mm-hmm. I'm talking
the
pure supercars. The supercar. I'm talking the watch that is 10,000 plus, you know, when my phone tells the time. And I could even get a very nice looking watch that's like £1,000 or £2,000, right? That's still, arguably, that's still a luxury. But then, you know, you get to the point where it's ridiculous, right? And that feels like the point where it's like, you know what? For most people, it's not a concern, mostly for lack of means. Mm-hmm. But I feel like for many people, to buy those goods is to communicate the fact that you perhaps haven't thought deeply enough about the conflict between these two needs. Mm-hmm. Like on the one hand, you know what? Yes, we're human. Yes, part of being human is sometimes, first of all, to enjoy things and not turn everything to a moral question. And secondly, you know, conveying social messages through what we're wearing or doing is part of the human experience. And to remove all of that, you know, we all have to wear burlap sacks because anything else is excessive, right? And there are people who can't eat. It suddenly is undermining really the lived human experience. To an extent, that might be more awful than the fact that some people are, basically everyone lives in Big Brother. But yeah, to me, it says like when people are buying these conspicuous spending goods, perhaps they haven't thought enough about this conflict between these two moral needs that we have.
Exactly. Now, before we wrap up, there's one other perspective that we should definitely bring in. I don't know that this is necessarily linked to any particular philosopher, and I don't even know really what to call it. So we'll just, for the sake of this, we'll call it the capitalist argument.
Yeah.
And this might be your initial reaction, listeners, when you first heard this question, are luxury goods immoral? Because we've asked enough people and we've said, what do you think about this? And I think actually a lot of people do kind of default to, no, of course not. Why does it matter? And a great way of encapsulating this would be the quote, if you earned your money fairly, you can spend it on whatever you want.
Yeah.
It's a free capitalist society.
Yep, yep, yep. And, you know, a lot of people, I remember I saw someone posted on LinkedIn and said this, you know, it was like, oh, Bezos bought like a £500 million yacht or whatever, like how ridiculous. And then someone else argued, well, think about all the people who worked on that yacht. Think about all the people whose families were fed by them working on that yacht. It's, you know, think about blah, blah, blah. And then basically saying like the point of capitalism is that like we don't judge what people spend as long as they acquire their money fairly. And people are generally doing value productive things. You know, everyone, the only thing that we should regulate out of existence is people not taking more value than they're putting out as part of their business.
Yeah. But you can't regulate for bad taste.
Yeah. But you can't. And, you know, it's funny because there is a really appealing argument around that, I would say for sure. But how do I articulate this?
Well, for my part, I think this is a slightly lazy perspective.
Yeah.
Because I think it's an easy way to make excuses for not thinking about the opportunity cost argument. And it appeals to the social context in which we live, where actually a lot of these goods are positioned as quite aspirational. So in the way that you described in the first episode, people look at Rolexes and while to me and you, we might think that's a bit distasteful. It's flashy. It's showy. You could have done something better. There's a lot of people who probably like, man, that's cool. Like, like that's where I want to be. That's where I want to get to. Or you live or operate that's in a context where loads of people wear these kind of things and you have to keep up with the...
Yep. And to be fair, I think also we have to be fair that like, we have to think about our own context, right?
Yeah.
So we grew up in contexts, I mean, for anyone who hasn't picked it up so far, where we were like comfortable growing up and then went to a relatively intellectual university with a lot of people who had money, perhaps kind of in that comfort of wealth where like there wasn't much need to convey wealth, right? Like everyone was comfortable. Maybe you had some people in the ridiculous end, and even then, like, you know, to act like you're rich at Oxford, you know, you're with some of the richest people in the world, so that's like another level. but I'm just saying, like, okay, maybe we're approaching this from our own like privilege where we haven't had the context where like it really was an effective symbol and it wasn't considered distasteful. So maybe we're being a little bit unfair. I do think that like it's like we said, like, you know, maybe if you had some deeper thought, considered, for example, Singer and then considered Moral Saints on the other side, Susan Wolf, maybe you would come to some conclusion that's more similar to us. But maybe you've not been in a context where that's an obvious thing to do. Maybe you didn't study philosophy having come through a middle class life and a private school. And so maybe you end up at a different point. But sorry, back to the libertarian economic one or capitalist one. I do think, though, it's one of those ones where it's like it's a difference between like a rule or a heuristic for society and a case by case, right? Because as a rule for society, it's hard to argue against. On a case by case, it seems obvious. Like if you ask me, would I rather or do I think it's morally better that Bezos donated $500 million or bought himself a yacht. But I acknowledge that the yacht does have positive effects through like economic production. It seems obvious that like, you know, it's better for all humanity if he donated that to like GiveWell or some other charity where like they could effectively alleviate. You know, do I think it's better that Bill Gates does the Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, versus, you know, making super yachts for himself? Like, you know, of the two, obviously, I think one of them is doing quote unquote like more moral good whilst even still being extremely wealthy. And I think also it's even if it's creating an economic value chain, it's such an excessive use of the money that it becomes a little bit gross. It really comes back to the argument we made in the first episode, should billionaires exist, which maybe we should revisit at some point. It's been a while. Where like part of the problem with it is just how tone deaf it is in a context where some people can't eat.
It's why the opportunity cost matters. It's why that's the most important argument that we've made in this episode. And it's exactly that. In a world of immense inequality and literal poverty, to spend money in a sort of flashy way that shows off your wealth.
Even if it's economically productive.
Yeah.
I mean, think about who it's economically productive to. It's not to the people who are worst off. No. It's the people who service people who have super yachts. It's the yacht brokers and engineers.
I think that's okay. It. I think it's
so what if Bezos paid $1.5 billion to build it in a developing country where they trained people? It would be better.
It would be better, but it's still the ultimate. I mean, what's the purpose of the yacht, right? I mean, if he wanted to make the people in the developing countries better off, he could just have donated the money.
So that's true. And then, like, what? They're going to keep, I guess part of the problem there is sustainability. Like, they have to keep making super yachts for, like, the five richest people in the world.
To be fair, once he's bought his there, you could imagine. The orders come flying in.
Yeah.
But that's it. The opportunity cost is the best way of summarizing that. So, I mean, we've kind of given our conclusions here at this point, but Ant, how would you summarize your answer to are luxury goods immoral?
I guess at a high level, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But a la Susan Wolf and Moral Saints, like there's different classes, and we'd highlighted those two types of luxury goods. One, I think it's clear, like it is immoral, like it is wasteful. It's resources that would be better spent. And even if you want status, communicate status. Nowadays, you know, arguably it communicates more status to do good and be a philanthropist than it does to waste money on things.
It would be a better world if that was...
more of a status symbol.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do acknowledge that there's that gray area where like some things are expensive but good value and they are like quote unquote a luxury good. As in like literally if you had less money, you'd buy less of it.
They're sort of luxurious necessities though.
Yeah, but they're kind of that blend in between, right? Yeah, like... buying bread that's not necessarily the cheapest bread in the shop, but is still bread. Buying a car that like, okay, it has an AC and it's an automatic, but like it's a car and I need to get around and it's not a crazy expense more. And then there's, especially when you start to consider that economic argument we had around like, okay, as long as my money is not ill-gotten. And by the way, sorry, another thing from the billionaire argument, like any system where you can acquire a ridiculous amount of wealth, you can start to say like, okay, if we're looking at the outcomes and understanding the distribution is an important part of how fair processes, as in like you could work backwards and say if there is a ridiculous distribution, something's wrong with our process, probably.
It's the system,
then you might say it's not fair. And also, you know, a part of fair transactions is assuming that there's fair acquisition of cash in the first place, which, you know, there's no starting point to history where we're like, okay, it's zero for everyone and go.
It's the beginning of the game of Monopoly.
Yeah, exactly. There is no beginning to the game. So that's another problem that we need to consider. And laws aren't perfect, so fair as in legal is not the same thing. But yeah, overall I'd say it's hard to draw the line for some of those luxury goods, but in that first category I gave, second category, it seems clear. I have the internal conflict of Moral Saints and Peter Singer. I want to do more. I try and give as much as I can, but I also need to like live a life I think is worth living. And I happen to not be one of those Moral Saints who like has that really, really strong internal drive to dedicate my life to just giving away everything. For me, drawing a line around that category of goods seems obvious, but you know, it's somewhere with the other category as well. Like there's some line, but it's harder to draw. What's your take? Oh, and the libertarian capitalist, not a huge fan of the argument. It feels like an even lazier way than the Moral Saints argument for justifying doing what you want to do.
Yeah. I mean, my takeaway would be to all the people whose intuitive answer is, hey, it's capitalism. People have preferences. You can buy what you want. Of course, they're not immoral. It doesn't matter. I hope that this episode has given you food for thought there in respect to the fact that there is an opportunity cost to every purchase you make. And I think what's interesting is in previous episodes, I've never been a fan of resolutions where the burden falls on consumers. This is a rare case where I think, you know what, if you're buying excessive luxury goods, that is a consumer decision where the opportunity cost is much clearer, where actually you should be more considered about the purchases you make. I think just like you, I feel a similar tension between the Singer argument and the Moral Saints argument because, and I think for me, that's just like how far up the pyramid do you draw the line? I think there's obviously...
Pyramid being Maslow's hierarchy.
Maslow's hierarchy of needs, exactly. I mean, there's physiological and security are like your two basics sort of for survival. you've got love and belonging, you've got self-esteem. And I think there's value in all of these things. I think to draw the line too far below that misses the essence of the human experience, right? Yeah. Like what is it to be human? If we, in a
so
world
much more
where
than
we,
surviving.
Exactly. In a world where we didn't have art, in a world where we didn't have entertainment, life would be a lot less. It's, you know, you can read Peter Singer and think, okay, we should give up these things for the sake of making sure everyone else has like the basics of like water and meet their financial needs. But then the outcome is a world that's quite boring for everyone. It's still better for the people who are obviously suffering. But like
to be more specific than boring, like we're talking like Big Brother style.
Yeah.
To be fair, there's not necessarily an authoritarian power, but that maybe that authoritarian power is a doctrine rather than force. Yes. Okay. More people get to survive, but life also at the best part becomes not really worth living.
Yeah, or certainly less
fulfilling.
That
sounds harsh, but you know what I mean.
Less fulfilling. And I think Wolf is quite refreshing as a perspective that says, actually, you know what? You don't need to be like moral all the time. Not everything has a moral quality. And I think a lot of people kind of feel that about sort of consumption, but I don't know that they necessarily should. I think there is a line. I'm not sure where to draw it, but I think there are things that we can obviously look at and say, to me, that's distasteful. That's
and they're
wasteful.
The conspicuous spending luxury.
Conspicuous consumption. Yeah, you could do better things with that. And I think I wouldn't, as a point of self-esteem on the pyramid, I don't know that I'd ever want to be the kind of person who
derives self-esteem from those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold me to account if we ever become hugely successful.
Likewise. I once had a windfall of cash and I was like, maybe I'll buy a nice watch. My dad told me off. And I was like, I'm lucky to, well, this is what I was saying about privilege and context earlier, right? Like maybe I happen to be in a social context where that is reinforced to me, which, you know, good, save me from wasting a bunch of money. Next, one thought, just a method of resolving that moral saints and Peter Singer argument.
Go on.
What if the question is about optimizing over the right time frame? Right. What if the understanding that humans have like fallibility and needs that are not just moral, actually the best way to optimize moral outcomes in the mid to long term is to allow people enough freedom to also just enjoy themselves? Because a society where people, all they do is optimize utility in the short term becomes a painful one to live in.
Why does the time frame matter?
Just because, well, what I'm saying is, and like, I think what that Susan Wolf kind of addressed this point, like you can't include these non-moral things in your moral framework. But I mean, if you kind of don't value them morally, but acknowledge that humans need to have, you know, enjoyable lives, it's kind of the argument that like, this is a bit of a twist of it, but it's a bit like, oh, like if my aim is to save lives by giving cash away, if I actually don't give all of it away such that I can build an enjoyable life and build up wealth, then I could actually give away more later.
I see. It's a bit like effective altruism, right? It's the 80,000
kind of
to an extent.
Like, I mean, if you think about Singer's thing, in a way, hey, is Bill Gates super rich? Yes. Has Bill Gates actually, from a utilitarian perspective, done way more good than the person who has given away half their salary for their whole life? Yes. Because that's also how they managed to build a life where they had much more to give away. And then you could also think about, don't just think about it in terms of cash. Think about it as in like your moral internal motivation and resource. Right?
Well, Bill Gates built up prestige and reputation as well, right? Which allows his decisions to have more impact.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's what you meant, but just my point
is just that it's similar, but my point is just like, you know, if Susan Wolf is saying like this stuff creates boring, pointless lives, what if our understanding is that like, look, we need to make life worth living, which means that the best way for people to do the most good in the midterm is to actually consider morality and think morally, but like give themselves enough space to enjoy life so that they're not switched off from this whole like, I should do good, which actually isn't really her point. It's a way of justifying the two and finding yourself somewhere in the middle. Right?
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best. It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Yeah, this reminds me of a really interesting discussion with one of my mates, Will Davison, about this. And he was saying, like, when you sort of think about your life, it's actually exactly this kind of framework. Is like, we tend to think very short term, but if you were to think on a longer term, you could look at your life as like, you know, everything up to your sort of 20s and even 30s is a time to sort of train up and build skills. Yeah. And if you're giving away everything at this point, you know, you that's a time to invest in yourself, because that will permit you in the sort of longer term to
have
do more good and more impact. And he was saying,
if you're giving away all your income at this point,
yeah,
you don't ever build up the savings
yep. and the it's kind of
using money as the metric.
Using money as the metric.
But I'm talking more willpower. Same thing. Like, you know, am I going to depress myself by like depriving myself of human joy? Like, actually, in the mid to long term, maybe that means I can do less because I'm just not bloody motivated anymore.
Exactly. The question and we were asking was like, at what point in your life does that sort of balance switch? Because we were saying for now, it feels like in your 20s and probably 30s, that's the time where you want to be investing in yourself and building up your own kind of, I don't know, social capital and like
and also capital literal and, capital.
Yeah, exactly. But at some point, perhaps in your
30s
even
and 40s, to the midterm game goal of giving it away.
When you have more sort of influence and ability, you can be more effective in the way that you give back. Interesting question. And I think, yeah, one that different people will have different sort of answers to when they decide to do that.
Cool.
Awesome. Probably not a bad time to wrap up the episode.
No. Guys, final reminder, please do share with friends and family, leave a review, send us a message. And if you do want to support us for as little as a dollar a month, Patreon does mean that we're able to actually, you know, continue producing this stuff and put out 2 to 3 episodes a month. So
please
do. And also we will prioritize chatting to the people who send us messages through that platform.
Yep. We really appreciate it, guys.
And you'll also get a personal shout out.
Yes. Thank you for all your support. We'll be back soon with more episodes. And actually, very soon, we'll be back with we'll be releasing a TikTok.
Oh, God. Yeah. We'll let you know when that's out. But, you know, hashtag growth strategy. Speak soon, everyone.
Cheers, guys. Bye.